Welcome to the deep dive. For you law students tuning in, let's immediately consider a fundamental fork in the legal road. How does the justice system approach a young person versus an adult? It's not just a matter of age, it's a completely different underlying philosophy.
Right.
In juvenile justice, the core aim isn't primarily punishment, but guiding a young person toward rehabilitation. Think about the key principles. Parens patria, where the state acts as a guardian, the least restrictive disposition, meaning we intervene only as much as absolutely necessary, and, crucially, individualized assessments that recognize the unique circumstances of each child.
That's right. It's a system designed on the understanding that young people are still developing and their mistakes shouldn't automatically, you know, define their future. The emphasis is on figuring out what's driving the behavior and offering the support needed to get back on track.
And to really see these principles in action, or perhaps where they face challenges, we're diving into a case out of Indiana, in the matter of ELV State. This case perfectly highlights the tension between these rehabilitative ideals and, well, the practical realities of the legal system.
Uh-huh.
So what's on our roadmap for this deep dive? We'll unpack the specifics of EL's situation, the precise legal question before the Indiana Court of Appeals, the court's ultimate decision, the reasoning behind it, and why this particular ruling carries significant weight in the broader field of juvenile law.
This case really pushes us to ask whether juvenile courts are consistently prioritizing that foundational principle of rehabilitation, or if other factors, perhaps the desire for efficiency or even pre-existing assumptions, can sometimes overshadow that primary goal.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Exactly. And to set the stage, let's look at the very foundation of Indiana's approach. The law states, and I quote, "It is therefore the policy of this state to ensure that children within the juvenile justice system are treated as persons in need of care, protection, treatment, and rehabilitation." That really lays bare the fundamental intention behind the juvenile court.
It does. That statement is sort of the legal and ethical bedrock upon which all decisions regarding juveniles should ideally be built.
Okay, so let's unpack EL's story. Back when this particular incident occurred, she was a 17-year-old mother living with her grandmother. Now, it's important to note that this wasn't her first involvement with the juvenile system. In 1999, she had a prior commitment to the Department of Correction.
Okay.
That prior history is definitely part of the context here.
Indeed. That prior commitment is a significant piece of context that likely influenced the juvenile court's initial perspective.
Yeah.
However, the critical question we need to keep in mind is whether that past history should automatically dictate the present and future course, especially when there's evidence of substantial positive change in the interim.
Right. So fast forward to March 2002, EL had an altercation with her visiting mother. Things escalated, and in the heat of the moment, EL threw some picture frames. Her grandmother called the police.
Uh-huh.
And when they arrived, EL was reportedly quite agitated, screaming and crying. And she didn't calm down when the officers asked her to.
Yeah.
This ultimately led to her arrest for disorderly conduct.
And it's absolutely crucial to pay attention to what happened next in the legal process.
Yeah.
EL entered into a plea agreement. As part of this deal, the more serious charges of battery and criminal mischief were actually dismissed.
Right.
And she admitted just to the lesser charge of disorderly conduct. That's a key distinction.
Absolutely. She wasn't adjudicated on those more significant offenses. Now, here's where the narrative takes a really important turn. In the 2.5 years between her release from that prior commitment in 1999 and this new disposition hearing in 2002, well, EL had demonstrated some really significant positive changes in her life.
This is the heart of the matter, isn't it? It underscores the very reason the juvenile system prioritizes rehabilitation. The remarkable capacity for growth and transformation in young people, even after, you know, prior involvement with the justice system.
Exactly. She had a stable home environment with her grandmother. She was actively enrolled in a school-to-work program. She was on track to graduate high school.
Wow.
And perhaps most tellingly, she was a mother to a 1-year-old daughter and was reportedly very responsible and engaged in that role.
So when it came time for the disposition hearing, which, as we mentioned earlier, is essentially the sentencing phase in juvenile court, the defense presented a very specific argument. They advocated against automatically recommitting EL precisely because of this clear and substantial positive turnaround.
Makes sense.
Instead, their recommendation was probation coupled with court-ordered counseling, arguing that incarceration would likely undo all the progress she had made and negatively impact her ability to care for her child and finish her education.
And this brings us to the central legal question that the appellate court had to grapple with. Did the juvenile court exceed its authority? Did it abuse its discretion, as the legal term goes, by applying a blanket policy of automatic recommitment for any subsequent offense without truly considering EL's individual circumstances and determining the most appropriate and least restrictive way forward in her specific situation?
It's classic legal tug of war, isn't it? The inherent tension between the understandable desire for consistency and predictability in applying rules and the fundamental principle of individualized justice, especially within the nuanced context of the juvenile system.
And the appellate court's answer to that question was a clear and decisive yes. They ruled that the juvenile court had indeed abused its discretion. In their view, this blanket policy of automatic recommitment created an unconstitutional presumption of incarceration and directly contradicted the fundamental spirit and intent of Indiana's juvenile code.
Mm.
So the key insight here is that even with prior offenses, the law demands juvenile courts see a child's potential for change and tailor the response accordingly. Automatic punishment, even for repeat offenses, can be illegal if it ignores that individual growth.
That's a really significant finding. It essentially establishes that a juvenile court cannot simply operate with a one-size-fits-all approach when deciding the future of a young person, particularly when that young person has demonstrated a genuine capacity for positive change and has taken concrete steps towards rehabilitation.
And the appellate court didn't hold back in their language. They stated, and this is really key quote that gets to the heart of the matter, "In each case, the mission of the juvenile court must be to make an individualized determination of the most appropriate and least restrictive disposition, considering the best interest of the juvenile, as well as the safety of the community."
That quote really encapsulates the core tension we've been discussing and the appellate court's ultimate decision. It firmly places the emphasis back on that individualized assessment and the critical balancing act between the juvenile's specific needs and the legitimate concerns for public safety.
Okay, so let's really dig into the appellate court's reasoning here. First, they honed in on this concept of abuse of discretion. For our law student listeners, this is a crucial standard of review. What exactly does it signify in this legal context?
Essentially, an abuse of discretion occurs when a lower court's decision is clearly against the logical facts and circumstances presented, or when the court has fundamentally misinterpreted or misapplied the relevant law. It's not just that the appellate court would have decided differently, but that the lower court's decision was unreasonable or legally flawed.
Got it.
In EL's case, the magistrate actually acknowledged the significant progress she had demonstrably made. However, the magistrate explicitly stated that they felt constrained by a pre-existing court policy mandating recommitment for any subsequent offenses.
So they saw the good stuff but felt stuck.
Exactly. It's like saying, I see the progress, but the rules prevent me from acting on it. And this is where the appellate court took significant issue. They drew a stark contrast between the fundamental rehabilitative goals that underpin the entire juvenile justice system and the inherently punitive effect of an automatic recommitment. Sending EL back to the Department of Correction would, in all likelihood, completely derail her education, her ability to care for her young child, and the hard-won overall stability she had achieved. It's like hitting the undo button on all that positive development.
It really does sound counterproductive to the very goals of the juvenile system. It's almost working against itself.
Exactly. It fundamentally undermines the purpose of the juvenile system if clearly demonstrated progress is simply disregarded in favor of a predetermined outcome based solely on a prior offense without considering the individual's current circumstances.
Yeah.
Furthermore, the appellate court underscored the vital principle of the least restrictive alternative. Given the compelling evidence of EL's progress, probation coupled with counseling appeared to be a perfectly viable and significantly less harsh option.
Right. It could address the disorderly conduct without blowing up her life.
Precisely. It could effectively address the incident without completely upending her life. Remember, juvenile justice isn't just about the harshest penalty. It's about the right support. And that's legally mandated to be the least intrusive option that still addresses the issue.
So, zooming out a bit, what are the wider implications of this ruling for juvenile justice as a whole? It seems to send a pretty strong message about these kinds of blanket policies.
It absolutely does. It really shines a light on the inherent dangers of such rigid policies within the juvenile context. They run the significant risk of stripping juvenile courts of the very flexibility they need to meaningfully address the unique circumstances presented by each individual case.
Yeah, flexibility seems key.
While there might be an understandable temptation towards judicial efficiency in implementing such broad rules, This case forcefully reminds us that such efficiency cannot come at the expense of fundamental constitutional and statutory safeguards designed to protect juveniles.
It's that constant balancing act, isn't it? Trying to manage often overwhelming caseloads and ensure a degree of consistency in the system while still rigorously adhering to the core principles of individualized justice, it sounds tough.
Precisely. And this case truly stands as an important legal precedent. It strongly reinforces the absolute requirement for juvenile courts to conduct a thorough and case-specific analysis when determining appropriate dispositions. They are legally obligated to actively consider several critical factors.
Okay, like what?
First and foremost, the child's welfare and their paramount best interests. Secondly, the safety and well-being of the community. And thirdly, they must always diligently explore and prioritize the least restrictive dispositional options that are available and appropriate for that specific child.
So for the judges and courts on the ground, what's the key practical takeaway here? What do they need to actively do differently in light of this ruling?
The most critical practical takeaway is the absolute necessity for meticulous documentation. Juvenile courts must clearly and comprehensively articulate their individualized reasoning within their dispositional decrees.
Spell it out, basically.
Exactly. They need to explicitly demonstrate that they have thoroughly considered the specific facts of the case, the juvenile's background, any evidence of progress or lack thereof, and precisely why the chosen disposition represents the most appropriate and least restrictive option in that particular situation. Failing to provide this clear and detailed rationale leaves their decisions vulnerable to being overturned on appeal.
And earlier, you mentioned the abuse of discretion standard. Can you just briefly revisit how that differs from a de novo review and why that distinction is important in understanding this ruling?
Certainly. In a de novo review, an appellate court essentially evaluates the case anew without giving any particular deference to the lower court's findings or legal conclusions. It's like starting from scratch, looking at the law and facts fresh. The abuse of discretion standard, however, is a more deferential standard. It acknowledges that trial courts, being closer to the facts and the parties, have a certain degree of leeway or discretion.
They get some leeway, but not unlimited.
Exactly. As this case clearly illustrates, even under this more lenient standard, there are definite limits to that discretion. When a court's established policies directly contradict clear statutory mandates, like the fundamental requirement for individualized assessments in all juvenile cases, then that discretion has been legally abused. The policy itself was the problem here.
That distinction really clarifies why the appellate court was able to step in here, even without retrying the facts. Finally, just to ensure everyone following along is clear on the sequence of events, can you quickly clarify the difference between the adjudication phase and the disposition phase in Yale's case?
Absolutely. The adjudication phase is essentially the fact-finding stage. It's where the court determines whether the juvenile committed the alleged offense. In EL's case, this occurred when she entered into that plea agreement, admitting to disorderly conduct.
Right, where the battery charges got dropped.
Correct. The disposition phase, on the other hand, is akin to the sentencing phase in adult criminal court. It's the stage where the court decides what happens next, the consequences or interventions.
And that's where the bad policy came in.
That's exactly where the juvenile court's blanket recommitment policy was applied. And that application was the specific subject of this appeal.
Okay, that makes the different stages very clear.
Okay.
So to bring all of this together, the core takeaway from In the Matter of EL is that juvenile justice, at its very core, demands a delicate and thoughtful balance. It's about holding young people accountable, yes, but it must always be fundamentally guided by a genuine and active commitment to recognizing the potential for growth, change, and ultimately rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. Rigid, one-size-fits-all solutions simply cannot align with the foundational principles and the legally mandated individualized approach of this unique system.
Precisely. And this landmark case serves as a powerful and enduring reminder of the paramount importance of upholding those individualized considerations in every single juvenile disposition. It's not optional, it's required.
So for you law students who are joining us on this deep dive, here's a crucial question to really consider. Given that the juvenile court in EL's case openly acknowledged her significant rehabilitation efforts, how can juvenile courts best navigate that inherent tension between the understandable need for consistent and predictable policies?
Which are important for fairness, too.
Right, fairness and efficiency. But balance that with the clear statutory mandate for individualized dispositions, especially when dealing with young people who have had prior involvement with the system. It's a complex and critically important question, and one that continues to shape the ever-evolving landscape of juvenile justice.
It certainly is. And a thorough understanding of cases like In the Matter of EL is an absolutely crucial step in effectively grappling with those complex and vital issues. There are no easy answers, but the law demands we try.